Good afternoon. In the interest of time, we are going to move ahead. It is 1:30. House Judiciary is in session, in attendance. My friend Representative Lynn, myself, my own friend, Representative Ramris,
better be.
Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Holmes, and Representative Fruenberg is on his way shortly. I think Representative Coghill and Samuels will be coming along. We are delighted to be hosting Senator Elton. It's very nice to have you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So far, that's the politest introduction I've ever gotten.
Yeah.
Well, good.
I like this committee.
The hospitality committee.
We haven't voted yet.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Senator Kim Elton. I represent District B, which is Juneau, and hopefully we've been good hosts to you this year and in past years. I'm not going to read the sponsor statement or paraphrase the sponsor statement because this is a pretty straightforward bill. I'm going to apologize at the beginning that as soon as I'm off the hot seat here, I'm going to go to, I've got my choice of two committees that I'm scheduled to be at next. But I just want to make a few points before I have to leave. First, Senate Bill 121 simply restores the alternative compliance discharge protocols that were codified by the legislature in 2004. The alternate compliance law for small cruise ships was because the technology doesn't fit on the ships. And so what the legislature did in 2004 is they came up with a recipe for alternative compliance. They worked it out with the Department of Environmental Conservation and at that time adopted the alternative recipe that sunsets in 2016. We're back again before you because one of the things that happened, and it was entirely an oversight, is that the cruise ship initiative bill that was voted on by the voters repealed the section of law that we had adopted in 2004. It wasn't their fault. It wasn't the initiative sponsor's fault. But they had filed their initiative before House Bill 522, which was in 2004, before it was a twinkle in anybody's eye. We just failed to notice it when we passed the bill 40-0 in the Senate and 20-0 or 40-0 in the House and 20-0 in the Senate. So we're back restoring it. I just want to say that the initiative sponsors have testified in support of restoring what had been undone. We've not heard anybody testify against it, either in committees on the Senate side or so far on the House side. And I would commend the bill to your attention. I think this is something that needs to be fixed, and in the past, nobody had a problem with it, and so far, nobody's had a problem with it here in the present. I'll try and answer very quickly, Mr. Chair, any questions you might have, and if you get to a tough question, I'm going to have my staff come up and I'll walk out of the room at that point in time.
As we all do.
Thank you, Senator. Just the same question I asked you before the hearing began, which is, how did the people know? How do we know that people didn't mean to put the same restriction on the small ships as they did the large cruise ships? How do we know that? How do the sponsors know that?
Yeah, it was the restrictions that you're talking about that were in the initiative, Mr. Chair, are not restrictions imposed by the initiative. The wastewater, other than the Ocean Ranger component of the program, which is monitoring, it's not the restrictions on wastewater. Those were all accommodated by the legislature in the past and codified in law in the past. And at that point in time, that's when we did the alternative compliance for the small cruise ships because these are ships, Mr. Chair, that have less than 150 overnight berths, it would have required cutting the ships in half, installing machinery that they couldn't handle and that would make them unseaworthy if they were mandated to comply with the other law. The initiative is a compliance review. It didn't impose wastewater restrictions that weren't already imposed in law.
Thank you. Are there other questions for Senator Elton? Senator Olney, a pleasure to have you here.
I do.
Representative Grimberg.
This is not relating to this bill.
Oh.
But to the process. As I understand it, generally, sponsors filed an initiative, and subsequently, the legislature passed a bill on the subject. But if that passage by the legislature was after this, how could they repeal that in the initiative? If the bill wasn't even passed, how can you appeal with something that wasn't passed?
And this is a complicated question, actually, not a simple question, a complicated answer. So please bring me back if I don't explain it to your satisfaction. What happened when we passed, when the alternative compliance for small cruise ships was introduced, at that point in time, the compliance for the small ships was put in the statute, in a statute that was going to be repealed if, in fact, the initiative passed. The initiative sponsors had that repeal provision in their initiative. We just, as the legislature, we just failed to note that we were amending statute in a place that would be repealed if, in fact, the initiative passed. Did that
help? It was an existing statute.
It was an existing statute, yes.
So do we want to, through the chair, do we want to bring the bill? I haven't read this, I got to tell you. Are we bringing the bill back to its unamended status then?
Yes, this just replaces what we had done and also includes the language that has it sunsetted in the year 2016 because in 2004 we had a sunset provision because we assumed that the technology in 2016 was going to be far greater than and far better than the technology that we had in the past. So not only does it restore the language, it also restores the sunset date for the alternative compliance.
If I may, we seem, at least in the House, to be grappling with a series of different things relating to initiatives and have over the last several years. This is a fact scenario we haven't come across before. I'm just wondering, since you're a member of the unnamed other body, maybe the legislature, both the Senate and the House, ought to take a look at providing for such a contingency procedurally in the future because it's not unlikely to reoccur. And I don't have anything more in mind than that, but I can see an initiative moving forward and legislation moving forward and them being in conflict. And it's more cumbersome to do something with an initiative than it is with bills that might be introduced. But there ought to be some way of getting them into compliance with each other. Otherwise, we're going to face stuff like this potentially, future legislators, that's going to, particularly with technologically related bills, it's going to come up more and more. And I just sort of commend it to the members of the committee and you and several of us sit on state affairs. There ought to be some procedure to deal with this.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, this is one of the reasons I admire the House, because you do noodling and try to think things through. I guess my only response is I'm willing to help do that.
I don't need
the problem is, I think this is a very unusual fact situation. I mean, I'm hopeful that we don't have this fact situation again. And so, alternatively, in trying to get to where you want to go, I think it would take an awful lot of thought on what other fact situations could present themselves.
Yeah.
It may be just a problem that is inherent with the initiative process. I would just end by saying it may just be a problem with the initiative process where you don't go through a committee system and then you end up having to come back and doing tweaking that is necessary to meet what the sponsors wanted and what Alaskans expect.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Senator. I just wanted to let the record reflect you've been asked a question by perhaps the greatest noodler of all the Alaskan State House representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope that the representative knows that you're the one that applied that appellation directly to him. I was just doing it generally.
Yeah, but it's a question that we really ought seriously.
Yes.
That I don't have an answer. It's just sort of worth thinking about. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative.
Any questions for Senator Lee? Pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, members of the committee.
Good luck on this.
My staff person is here if there are additional questions, and I think there are some people online that actually deal with us on a daily basis, and they can maybe be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. We have with us Bryce Brockway from Cruz West. Bryce, are you on the line? You hung up? Before we take Michael Jones, it occurred to me, because we're all so greatly distracted, I meant to pass the gavel on this issue because it relates to the cruise ship industry, which I have a close economic relationship, of which I have an ethics advisory request into the legislature, and I'm sorry that I failed to do that. So on that note,
I'm sorry.
After having had the opportunity to pay Representative Gruenberg a fine, well-deserved compliment, I will be turning over the gavel to Vice Chair Dalton. My apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Mr. Brockway is no longer with us. All righty. The next person we have online is Michael Jones. Michael, are you available?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chairperson and committee members. My name is Michael Jones. I am the Director of Marine Operations for Lindblad Expeditions. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to provide testimony today. Lindblad Expeditions has been operating our two small passenger vessels, the Seabird and the Sea Lion, in southeast Alaska since 1989. Seabird and Sea Lion are U.S.-built, flagged, owned, operated, as well as crewed with U.S. crew. Our vessels are identical. They're sister ships, and they have a capacity of 62 passengers per ship. We call on the ports of Juneau, Petersburg, and Sitka. House Bill 522 provided for a process for the Department of Environmental Conservation to review and approve alternate compliance programs for small passenger vessels starting in the year 2004. The system has worked very well, and we have been registering annually with the department utilizing this process. The cruise ship initiative last year inadvertently removed the section of regulations that provided for the small vessel alternate compliance program. We support Senate Bill 121 in its intent to reinstate the small vessel alternate compliance program recommended by the Department of Environmental Conservation that was provided for by House Bill 522. I'd be happy to answer questions at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. We appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions for members of the committee? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify? Representative Gruenberg?
I just would like to ask the representative from the Department of Law a question.
That's fine with me. If she would like to come up, please. And again, state your name and position. Thank you for being here with us.
Ruth Hamilton Heskey, Alaska Department of Law.
Go ahead, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Ms. Heskey. Nice to see you again. I'd like you to refer to your department's fiscal note, page 2. There's some coding in here that I don't understand, abbreviations.
Chair and Representative Rumer, sorry to interrupt. I don't have a copy of the fiscal note in front of me, unfortunately.
Do we have an extra? Yeah. And I don't mean to put you on the spot if you're not the right person.
Thank you.
If you'd look at page 2.
Okay.
Representative Gruenberg, are you talking about fiscal note 1 or 2?
1.
All righty.
It says, as described in the sponsor's statement, the bill, quote, adopts an alternate compliance program for a group of small cruise vessels, blah, blah, blah. This assertion in the sponsor statement appears to be essentially correct, although the bill apparently proposes as a new concept that all commercial passenger vessels, large and small, be required to have a GP when discharging in the state. et cetera. What's a GP?
GP is a general permit. I might clarify, though, for Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, to the committee members, that I believe the bill is actually not requiring small cruise vessels to have a permit, general or individual or otherwise. I think the bill is drafted so that a BMP program, best management practices program that was authorized in 2004, apply to the small cruise vessels as it did previously. So I don't believe that the bill intends to set it up for a permit system.
Okay, well, I'm glad we clarified that. And if I may, Madam Chair?
Please, Representative Gruenberg.
And then it says law and DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation, are still reviewing the bill to see if it deviates in any other respect from the previous implemented best management practice program. And I'm just wondering if that review has been completed and what the answer is, if it has.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, we have conducted a review. We believe that it is consistent. The bill would restore the program consistent to what it was before.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Are there any further questions for Ms. Hesse? Any members? All right. Thank you. We appreciate your being here.
I would ask, I'm sorry, one more question, if I may.
Go ahead, Representative Gruenberg.
Does the Department of Law see any legal problems with the bill?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I don't believe we have called out any problems with the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. That being said, I'd like to ask again if there's anybody in the audience that wishes to testify. All right, with that, I'm going to close the public testimony. Are there any comments or conversation that members of the committee would like to have about this particular issue?
Madam Chair, would you like a motion?
I would like a motion, please.
Madam Chair, I would move CS for Senate Bill 121 LNC 25-L S0734 /L with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Alrighty, are there any objections from members of the committee? All right, seeing none, the CS for Senate Bill 121 version L is moved from committee, and if everyone would sign the document, please. And with that, I'll turn the gavel back to Chair Ramos for the next bill.
Okay, so I'll just wait for this package to come around. Representative Olson, we're delighted to have you.
Sorry.
Okay, wonderful. Representative Olson, if you'll pop up here, is Conrad going to help you?
Oh, I think it'll be both of us. I think it'll be more Conrad than me, but I'd be absolutely delighted.
Wonderful. We are taking up House Bill 128, an act relating to allowable lease expenditures for the purpose of determining the production tax value of oil and gas, for the purpose of the oil and gas production tax, and providing for an effective date. We heard this in House Oil and Gas. Representative Samuels, Representative Dahlstrom, the prime sponsor, and I sat on that committee. It moved from oil and gas to resources, was assigned to a subcommittee in resources, and my understanding is that it got hung up on the legal definition of the phrase improper maintenance, and so as such, it moved out of resources with a vote of 7-1, I believe, to be with a referral to House Judiciary so that we could primarily take up that legal issue. With that, is that a pretty good overview of how we got here?
It's real good.
Okay, excellent. So with that, Representative Olson Conrad, pleasure to have you. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. That's really helpful. So we focus, and I understand there's another issue as to retroactivity. issue, is that a second issue through the chair? Because I heard it was, and if it is, I'd like to focus on the issue, both issues, particularly second.
Can we get into it after I introduce myself, I guess?
Oh, sure. Thanks. I'm sorry.
I mean, am I taking questions right now?
I overstepped myself.
For the record, I'm Kurt Olson, representative from House District 33. House Bill 128 is an attempt to answer one question, and that is, who should pay for improper maintenance on the North Slope? Should it be the citizens of the state of Alaska, or should it be the responsible party? This bill was an amendment by the Senate Resource Chair Tom Wagoner last year to PPT at the end. It did not reach the floor for reasons only known to the presiding officer of the Senate at that point in time. Had it become part of PPT, I'm tempted to say Senator B, but I won't. Become part of PPT, we would not be having this meeting today. I take no pride in ownership of this bill. It's the House companion to Senate Bill 180, or I'm sorry, Senate Bill 80. Conrad Jackson of my staff has bled over this bill for probably the last 2 months, and this has worked its way through the process and is here for any questions that you might have. I would urge you to support this bill. But in answer to the first question from Representative Gruenberg through the chair, the major issue was the one that Representative Ramirez brought up. I believe that the question on the retrospective nature of it was resolved, I believe, with the person that had that in the past committee. But I would defer to...
through the chair, I would hope that we could address that as well.
Conrad, nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson. Staff to Representative Olson, it's a pleasure to be before your committee, sir. Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, the retroactivity was brought up and I believe was fairly well issued, addressed by Mr. Don Bullock from Ledge Legal. Basically, the PPT is all a tax bill. This is an amendment to a tax bill. Being retroactive is nothing new. I believe in your package you'll find a memo from Mr. Bullock, if I can find the correct date. Off the top of my head, I believe it's a mid-March memo. I know you've got a large packet in front of you.
But I have one dated April 4th to Senator Huggins. But that's an amendment.
No.
That's one amendment. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, as you stated, a number of members have heard this bill, but for the to help out some of the members that have not, if I can go through just a couple of details of the bill that may help and bring everyone up to speed on where the bill sits right now. As we said, HB 128 amends the PPT. It adds another section or a subsection to 4355-165E, which are a list currently of 18 items that are not considered lease expenditures and therefore are not deductible from the producer's tax liability. What this new subsection 19 would do is disallow any expenses for repair or replacement of facilities or equipment that were not maintained or were improperly maintained, inadequately maintained. Basically, if you don't keep up your equipment, the state of Alaska doesn't pay for it. There are also three subsections in subsection 19 that relate to the shutdown or partial shutdown of facilities. And the easiest way, I think, to look at this would be if facility A is shut down due to improper maintenance, downstream facility B must be slowed down and continues to incur expenses because of this shutdown due to improper or lack of maintenance. The state of Alaska should not be paying to maintain, to keep active this facility because this facility was not maintained properly.
Would you do me a favor and just take us, since that's the key part of this, correct?
Yes, sir.
Could you take us through that again, just so it's explicit for everybody? Because I see that this is much more detailed than as the Committee of First Referral in House Oil and Gas, and we are just scratching at it. I'd like everybody to benefit from hearing that a second time. You did it well, but I just want to hear it a second time, because this is the crux of the issue, if I understand. Representative Olson?
To speed up the process, I wonder if it might be to the committee's advantage to bring Don Bullock up here and have him with Conrad, because some of the questions are going to be coming
sure,
over.
Sure, absolutely. Mr. Bullock, always a pleasure. Bullock, always a pleasure to have you here. But if you could take us through that brief narrative again, Conrad, it was very useful. And I'd be grateful if you could just do it again in the same manner.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Facility A, a gathering station, pick a facility that is improperly maintained. Because of that improper maintenance or lack of maintenance, that facility must shut down, and whatever production, oil or gas, is flowing through that ceases or is diminished. Facility B, that is farther downstream, has to be shut down or is a diminished capacity, and expenses are incurred at that facility. Under normal circumstances, all expenses would be in some form to some percentage be deductible. Because of the expenses that would be incurred in Facility B that are attributable to this shutdown in Facility A, this new subsection would disallow those expenses. Again, the people of the state of Alaska do not end up paying for someone else's mistake.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Beyond that, in prior committees, mainly House Resources, a new subsection 20 was added. Actually, let me back up a little bit. The basis of the bill is also a consultation between the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, who's responsible for the tax returns, in consultation with the Commissioner of DEC and DNR, and a new person was added, the head of the PSIO group, who was basically the PSIO was just made, just created by the governor with Administrative Order 234. The PSIO is a Petroleum Systems Integrity Office. Their whole lot in life will be to make sure things are maintained regarding infrastructure and facility in the state, production facility and infrastructure in the state.
Representative Grunberg, is that in the particular department?
That is under, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that is through Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you. That would be Mr. Hansen sitting right there in the monopoly tie.
Oh, you're the PS.
Mr. Banks is in charge of. He is actually the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Mr. Chairman.
And if I could just to flesh out one of your subjects, we had a Representative Holmes. We had in August of last year, we had a joint House and Senate Resources meeting at the Anchorage LIO. Not coincidentally, I believe it was the same day that. The offices were raided. Mm-hmm. I think it was August 31st. It was a unique day, just as this is a unique day. And the issue came up of whether the value of the oil lost during that period of time would be lost, and whether the field, it was indicated to us that the field to a degree would be flushed for a while afterward, meaning that some of the lost oil production would in fact be flush, and you would see some marginal incremental increase in production once we began to extract oil from the ground. But to a large degree, much of the oil resource was going to be lost to become now the last barrels of oil production because of that gap, that 90 or 120 day gap. So in fact, I don't believe that this bill addresses the loss of oil production and the value that would have accrued to the state. It merely addresses the cost of the expenses that were associated with the upstream and the midstream costs, as the sponsor has indicated. But this was precisely the subject matter that we discussed, which is where did that lost production go, and when do you recapture it if the field doesn't flush up so that as you go back into production, you're able to recapture all of the lost production for those 90 or 120 days. If in fact some of that production goes to the very end of the life of the field, then creates a very significant issue for the state. And that issue is not addressed here, but what is addressed is the nature of improper maintenance and the state having to absorb expenses in the interim when the flow of that oil production was disrupted and disturbed. Is that a pretty clear understanding, Conrad?
No, Mr. Chairman, yes, it is. It's expenses related to the repair and replacement of property or equipment that is either not maintained or is improperly maintained.
Very good. And Mr. Bullock, one of the issues that I'm aware of that hung up resources was the concern. We'd like to ask you, because I assume that you're our legal counsel. Did you draft this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Bullock. I'm with Legislative Legal. I am the drafter on this bill.
This is a Bullock special. We like we like these because you're you're an excellent attorney, and I personally appreciate all your work. One of the issues that I understood earlier that hung this bill up was a concern with various agencies or the Department of Law of whether this would be an enforceable provision. Can you speak to that in particular? Because to a large extent, that's how we ended up getting a judiciary referral, is to be able to make that determination that the language is explicit enough that this can move forward. Is that a good question, Representative Gruber?
You bet.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm...
And by the way, also, I hope you don't let go of your earlier question about the lost or delayed production, how that's going to be handled. I hope you come back and ask some more questions on that.
I think we will next year. I think this bill is narrower in scope.
But next year you'll do that?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Bullock.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I must say that this bill was a challenge to draft from the standpoint that no other state that I'm aware of gets involved with giving upstream deductions when you calculate the value on which the severance tax is based. And so I've been unable to find another state that has a standard for a deduction related to the production tax. So what we did is, just to back up a minute, the production tax under PPT is a percentage that's applied to the production tax value of oil and gas. And that production tax value of oil and gas is calculated by starting with the gross value at the point of production and then subtracting the costs of production to get to the taxable value. And generally, ordinary and necessary expenses are allowed to be deducted under 4355-165A, and then the section that this bill addresses, or the subsection E in 4355-165E, lists deductions or costs that are specifically not allowed to be deducted when determining the taxable value of production. So starting with the premise that this was a new approach, then we looked at, you know, actually what the state gives up when it gives the deduction. The tax rate's 22.5%. So on a dollar cost that's deducted, the state's effectively giving up 22.5 cents of that dollar in the deduction. And in addition, if it's a qualified capital expenditure, it's subject to an additional 20% credit. There is a threshold amount that you may have heard about, the 30 cents discussion. The companies are not allowed to take as a deduction capital expenditures below the result of multiplying 30 cents times the total production for the year. So the irony of that is, if production goes down, the 30 cents times smaller production lowers the floor, so more costs would be allowed to be deducted. So if you look at the credit and the deduction, the state could share up to 42.5% of field costs. What this bill does, and what we tried to do, was to develop a starting point for determining, in return for the credit, in return for the deduction, what level of attention do we basically expect the operators to meet? And the standard in this bill now is that we expect them to use good oil field practice. And that if they do something less than good oil field practice, the state's not going to give up the deduction or the credit. So the first thing we had to do, to back up, you know, we said, why don't you just say negligence? Well, to get to negligence, you have to have a standard. You have to have the reasonable, prudent person, or some other standard to start from before you can say that they didn't meet that standard. And so what this bill attempts to do is say that the standard is good oil field practice. And so if your performance is less than that standard, and this is where you get to the improper maintenance issue and no maintenance, then the state is not going to give up the deduction or the credits.
May I interrupt for a moment? I know it's a small table, and Conrad, we'd appreciate it if you would stay put. But I see that Mr. Blacknell just came in. Ethan?
Yes.
Hey. Could you pop up here and grab a chair? I know you're busy running all over the building. What I shared with the members is that although we heard this in oil and gas, and it was referred to resources, that it got hung up in a subcommittee for some time, and one of the greatest consideration was the enforceability. And we know that there was some consternation amongst the Department of Law on this issue. So I wondered if you could join Conrad and Mr. Bullock and speak to the Department of Law's concern over whether these are enforceable provisions and your ability to make a case if necessary if this were to be litigated by the oil companies. Representative Broomberg, you're nodding your head. You're agreeing with this approach this morning, mm-hmm. this afternoon? Very good.
Yeah, you're doing great. Far better than I could do. I'm really, really.
I'm going.
And I don't know if your name again. If Mr. Banks could, yeah, I don't know if he would be helpful in this group too. He's the guy that's going to be doing this, isn't he?
If there's room, Mr. Banks, we will let him up here. Feel worried.
I'm doing great because I'm not saying anything.
You know, as Norman and I discussed this before, this was something that I was really interested in. So.
Yes. Anyway, Mr. Banks, nice to see you also. All right. So, if I could first, Ethan, if you would engage with Mr. Bullock in so far as your concerns about the enforceability of this, if we are potentially asking the state of Alaska to appear in a court of law on the legislature's behalf. Do you feel that you are properly armed, or are we sending you into a gunfight with a knife?
If you have any comments to anybody, thank you. You're doing fine.
And I'm only doing so well because I've got your help.
No, I don't think so.
Representative Coghill, we're happy to see you. You're missing a good one. It's
Mr. Chairman, I just have one comment to start off with, is that it's common in auditing to determine what's ordinary and necessary. So there it is somewhat of a subjective standard that tries to be as objective as possible. But the standard for general deductions for oil field costs and production costs is ordinary and necessary. And that's the standard in 4355-165A. So
do we have that?
Maybe
one of you could just do what they have so we see what it is.
4355-165 generally talks about the allowable costs that can be deducted in determining the taxable value.
And through the chair, this is the normal kind of terminology that's used in tax law?
Ordinary and necessary is. Yes, sir.
I know that's standard with, you know, business deductions and stuff like that. Please, I'm sorry. I don't know.
I think so.
May I inquire?
Yes.
Since you're sort of, it looks like you're waiting for something, but maybe I should let you start, one of you guys.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to cast my mind back to what exactly the concerns were. I know you had a discussion with Robert Mintz on some concerns that he had. I'm not, with the language that I'm seeing here, I'm not uncomfortable with the Department of Law's ability to move forward. And I'm trying to remember exactly what it was that Mr. Mintz articulated, or Mr. Iverson. I don't know if Mr. Iverson's on the phone.
Ethan, I don't mean to put you on the spot, because the committee just wants to do a good job. Have you been working this bill through the process, or are you pinch hitting for somebody this afternoon?
I'm essentially pensioning for Mr. Mintz, who has done quite a bit of work with the department on this, and he is completely out of communication at this point. I think he's...
He may be on the... Is he on the phone?
No,
he's around the building somewhere. We're attempting to track him down.
Oh, good. Okay.
Okay. So I appreciate your point of view.
I'm sorry. I thought Mr. Mintz was on vacation.
No, we have, we understand that he's in the building.
Okay.
Is what I hear.
If I may, one of my interests, knowing very little about this, is that we don't put something in that's just going to breed litigation, because the parties don't know or don't agree on what this is. Let me ask, what is the process? Somebody will take a deduction, and then what happens? Could somebody explain how this works?
Yes, if you just give me just a moment, because I'm trying to put us in a particular direction. Thank you very much for coming, Stephanie. We appreciate it. Just sit tight. Mr. Banks, if you could help us a little bit, since you've kind of tracked this thing throughout,
I think, Mr. Chairman, my name for the record is Kevin Banks. I'm the acting director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And if Mr. Iverson were on the phone, I think we'd have the committee outnumbered here at the table. First of all, this is the way, as you correctly stated, I have been paying attention to how this bill has been progressing, both here in this body and in the other body.
Thank you.
And let me begin first by making the distinction. Department of Revenue has its responsibilities for collecting taxes. You have a list in 165E of what costs are not allowed. And so what this bill will do is add a couple of provisions that say the costs that are due to improper maintenance would not be allowed, and with some definition of how that would be done.
Let me interrupt you for a moment there, and Ethan or Mr. Bullock, what about the retroactivity? That was a concern that Representative Gruenberg had, so just because it may be to our benefit to approach this incrementally. Mm-hmm. We had a list of deductible expenses through the PPT, this definition of, what did you just say, Mr. Banks, improper maintenance
is one of them.
So is now an additional item that we're going to add to that roster,
mm-hmm.
with a retroactivity mm-hmm. component. And so, gentlemen, it's the two lawyers that are here that would be required to enforce that provision. What is the state's likely ability to make that an enforceable retroactive provision? If we were to go to court with the with one or all of the producers over the subject matter, is that, Mr. Representative Olson? Does that get to the heart of the matter of what we're doing here in judiciary? Is that correct? Okay, that's my understanding. Is that's why we have a judiciary referral?
Okay.
Is that this is one of the primary things, Mr. Bullock and Mr. Blackham?
In my opinion, there's not a retroactivity problem here. The PPT was already retroactive, not only to April 1st, but when it came to providing credits for expenditures that occurred up to 5 years prior to April 1st, the PPT itself is already retroactive. But given that doesn't necessarily validate future retroactivity issues. But in the 30s, there was a United States Supreme Court case, Welch against Henry, and I can't remember the site, but it had to do with a Wisconsin tax that was applied. The tax was change was made in 1935, and it would apply back to 1933. And it said that generally, given the importance of taxes, so the legislature can end a tax. And in that case, it was the tax was amended in the first session of the legislature that followed the initial filing for the tax. So, in other words, for example, if other issues in the PPT are there and have contributed to less than what they anticipated being received on April 1st, then you would have the power to go back and correct the PPT back to April 1st on those issues. And this is similar to that type of adjustment that time has passed, you've had a reasonable amount of time to look at the effect of the law, and you do have the power to change the law and make it retroactive.
Could I inquire in a moment? If I could just hear Mr. Blacknow's approach to the same question, and then you can feel free to ask either of them.
That's completely consistent with the research that I've done on the subject of retroactivity as well. Actually, the furthest back that I had seen in case law was about 13 months that the legislature had gone back. It sounds like my colleague has found a case that went back further than that, but I think that the timeline that we see out there in the law, that where we are now, there shouldn't be an issue.
There's also been more recent Alaska Supreme Court cases that have upheld the retroactivity of production tax regulations. I can't remember the dates, but it was in 1980 was one case. There's times in the past where there were changes made to the ELF, and also the separate accounting corporate income tax, AS-4321, was also retroactive.
Mr. Chair. Representative Grunberg, get away.
That answers my question, because my question was going to be whether there were any unusual provisions in the Alaska Constitution that might have led to a different result than the federal. But you've answered my question, so I don't have any further questions on that at the moment.
Very good. Mr. Banks, is the Division of Oil and Gas satisfied with the tools that are in your arsenal? You feel that if this were to progress to litigation, are you comfortable with this piece of legislation as it's presently written?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the answer is yes, but let me explain how the Department of Natural Resources relates to the Department of Revenue in this bill, as I understand it. The Department of Revenue may find, as a result of a taxpayer submitting their tax form, some cost. Maybe it's 3 months ago, maybe it was 6 months ago. And through audit, an auditor has now flagged an issue and believes that there may be some problem with a improper maintenance kind of issue, that some cost they've found has been, they have some concern about. At that point, the Department of Revenue has among its options the ability to consult with the Department of Natural Resources, the Commissioner of Resources, or, as it says here, the person responsible for oversight. That comes to the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office, which is housed in the Department of Natural Resources in my division, Division of Oil and Gas. And there will be staff in that organization who can offer their consultative services, so to speak, to the Department of Revenue as to whether or not a cost is improper as it is defined here in this legislation, and how it may be expanded in definition by the regulations of the Department of Revenue. Now, the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office, is its focus, its purpose, is to coordinate the oversight of those activities of the oil industry upstream of the regulated pipelines where other jurisdictions apply. So we intend to coordinate the activities and the regulatory authorities that the Department of Environmental Conservation has for environmental protection, to combine the and coordinate, I should say coordinate probably better, the various authorities that the Department of Natural Resources has for land use, water use, coastal zone management, plus also what authority the state has under contract through its leases and unit agreements with the lessees and the stipulations that apply in those agreements. And lastly, we will also be working with federal agencies like the Department of Transportation. Now, as I said, our focus is to provide oversight to make sure that the industry has in place appropriate quality assurance kinds of programs, and that they are meeting and following the plans that they have made. And that's the role of the PSIO. By itself, irregardless of what changes are made to the PPT. However, in order to exercise that function, we will have staff that will be monitoring the activities of the industry and perhaps could provide useful consulting services, so to speak, to the Department of Revenue should a question arise about a particular cost as being legitimate or not, or improper maintenance or not, or in making that finding. I would suspect, too, that if it were to be litigated and in some administrative hearing, that the PSIO would be responsible for assisting the Department of Revenue and providing testimony, expert witness type testimony in that context.
Representative Grimberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you folks able to really answer a question which I'm really kind of asking to the Department of Revenue? Are there any Department of Revenue folks available? Or are you capable of answering
between the two? John Iverson is not with us. I don't believe
he's let me tell you what my question
is. He's on the phone. Is it John Iverson with us by phone? Oh, wonderful. Mr. Iverson?
Me.
Hi, Mr. Iverson. Representative Gruenberg has a question for you. And then I want to remind the members that Judy Brady with the Alaska, with AOGA, the Oil and Gas Association, is with us. And after this question, I'd like to go to her to get a different point of view so that we are treating all of that come before this committee fairly.
Of course.
Mr. Iverson, Representative Gruenberg has a question for you.
Yeah, through the chair, Mr. Iverson or anybody else who's more qualified to answer this. It seems to me what the bill addresses is the deductibility of the cost of correcting and repairing the damage. Isn't that correct, basically, in 25 words or less? But right along, Company X would have been failing to maintain equipment, we'll say, and as a result, not expending the money they needed to, and the damage occurred. What I'm wondering is whether there are other tax issues that occurred in the prior tax years when they didn't spend the money they should have, when they were, let's say, in a really high tax bracket and the oil was really flowing, and they made more profits in those years than they should have had they expended the money they ought to have spent. And so they I don't even know exactly whether my logic is correct, but whether there are any issues involving prior tax years that ought to be re-examined as well to complete the government's oversight in this area. And I thought I probably should ask the Department of Revenue that question. Yeah, you're nodding. So, Mr. Iverson, I'll let you lead off through the chair with that. And I'm not exactly sure. I may have gotten myself, to use a phrase, wrapped around the axle here. But I want to know whether there, in a broad sense, any prior issues of prior taxable years that might be involved here, too, from a logical point of view.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that's a good question. And I think maybe the easiest way for me to lay it out would actually be kind of to discuss your earlier question in regard to how this would come up, how we would see this in the first place. And I kind of see this on two separate tracks. The first track would be kind of the normal audit cycle. So the taxpayer files their return, and then at some designated time, this round of returns came in March, at the end of March, we will probably be starting, we need to figure out, first of all, how to audit these particular types of upstream costs. You know, this is new territory for us. So we're putting together audit plans, doing risk assessments, that sort of stuff. We'd probably fire those, start our audit cycle in sometime next winter. We would be looking at expenses that are made, and the auditors would be looking for, in sort of suspect areas, large or unusual expenses, sort of the same sort of things we would look at for regular repairs and maintenance. And then if an auditor, there's some discretion here, the auditor needs to have good judgment, and then picking out certain suspect areas. And then from there, we check the AFEs, the authorizations for expenditures, and ask for support for whatever sort of deduction or credit the taxpayer is asking for. And really, that's going to be a sampling-type process because this is a really big bucket of costs, this upstream area. And it's not like we're going to be – we don't have the luxury of spending, nor would we want to spend a dollar to chase a dime. So it's not – we're not going to be going for every gasket or every spark plug or bolt. It's going to be things that stick out. The other side of that is stuff that makes the news. So we would be asking the Department of Revenue – or Department of Natural Resources, excuse me, about that. Now, the other interesting track is on – parallel with that is litigation. And, you know, as a for instance – now, I don't know personally the status of what's going on, if anything, in Department of Law's analysis of the state's case for the shutdowns and those damages. But, you know, were they to fire up a case, it could very well be that they would be looking farther back retroactively than we would be. I mean, there's obviously some trickle-down effect through tax planning, but I would not be surprised if a part of a claim, and again, this is just speculation on my behalf, I don't know what they have in mind, but if part of a claim would be for lost taxes in a legal action in litigation. You know, we really would be picking these things up either in the news or as the expenses are made and claimed. So I think we're pretty limited in terms of going back. Yeah, it would be when they're claiming the expenses is when we would be seeing it. And I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg, I'd just like to recognize that Representative Coghill and Samuels have joined us. There's little doubt, gentlemen, that you're having a busy day. So we appreciate you joining us here in Judiciary. We did move out Senate Bill 121 from committee, and we are focusing on the bill that went to House Oil and Gas that Representative Samuels, you and I, and Representative Dahlstrom heard. It's referred to resources, held in the subcommittee in resources, and voted out 7-1 and asked for judiciary referral to focus on the legal question of whether these are enforceable provisions in this bill so that the Department of Law through the Department of Revenue could mount a successful legal or overcome a successful legal challenge by the producers who may try and find some weakness in the provision. We've been addressing the issue of retroactivity as it relates to adding items to the list of deductible, non-deductible expenses to the PPT that was passed last year. Am I on point, Conrad?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't think I was listening, but secretly I was. okay, with that, Representative Grunberg, who has been the questioner of the day.
No, you have. Both of us have. Mr. Iverson, what you said is really helpful. So the state would potentially be proceeding on two fronts, generally. One, potentially a litigation front by the Department of Law concerning possible damages, and the other is making sure that the tax situation is correct, and that's what we're looking at here. What was kind of in my mind was, since these would go together in what you're saying, one looking at the other, whether there's a long enough statute of limitations in both the damages issue and the back taxes issue to accomplish the maximum protection for the state in this area. I'd like you or somebody from law and or Mr. Bullock, who was in, I think you understand what I'm saying, too. Do we have to look at any statutes of limitations to make sure that both arms of this can proceed as they need to?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I can certainly, I hope, help clarify that. We have 3 years from the time the returns are filed to complete our audits. What this legislation would require would be an amended return to be filed within, I believe it's within 90 days of when the tax, of when this bill, if this bill passed, it would be within 90 days of that, they would have to file an amended return, and that would trigger that. It's three years from the date of filing the return, which would also be, incidentally, the same amount of time that they would have to file claims for refund and credits. So there is that trigger point is kind of in the future, and I think that's picked up then. The rest of that is going to be picked up back to April 1st of 2006 with the enactment of the PPT.
I think Mr. Bullock, through the chair, Mr. Bullock was going to say something, too.
Yeah, I just have, through the chair, I have two comments on that. There's a transition provision in Section 4 of the bill starting on page 4, lines, starting on line 28. And that tells what the operators and the producers are expected to do after this bill passes. In general, there is the three-year statute of limitations that Mr. Iverson referred to, and the Department of Revenue basically has 3 years to audit, and the taxpayers have 3 years to file amended returns and correct any errors on their own that they find in their returns.
Mr. Chair, how does that relate to the statute of limitations for the damages claim? What I'm, you know, I just want to be sure generally that we're protected.
Department of Law might know better, but there's the statute of limitations of 6 years generally on claims that the state has. There are exceptions, but
see, Mr. Chair, what was said a minute ago was that one of the claims might be for taxes lost, and I want to be sure that one way or the other, I'm not seeking to have the state recover twice for the same loss, but I want to be sure that we don't get barred unduly by a statute of limitations. And obviously, I see that you are pondering this. I don't necessarily need an answer instantly, but I want you to think of this before this gets to the governor's desk.
Thank you. If I could, let's get Judy Brady on the line just so we get a different, point of view. Judy, are you with us?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am. Can you hear me?
We hear you just fine, Judy. When are you leaving AOGA?
At the end of June, sir.
That will be a loss for the state of Alaska. You have been a brilliant spokesperson for that organization. It's nice to hear your voice.
I appreciate it. Thank you. For the record, my name is Judy Brady. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. As some of you have heard in committees in the past, AOGA opposes this legislation, and I'd like to just set a context. We don't have a whole lot of time. I could spend a couple of minutes setting context, and then a couple of minutes explaining why we're opposing what we're concerned about.
Judy, we're actually managing the clock very well. This is the last piece of business that we have up today, isn't that right, Jane? Can we just take up these two things? So you really have plenty of time to expound and present whatever you prefer.
Thank you very much. It's hard to listen or talk about or think about a PPT right now with the kind of background that's being played out. But just for some context, we had a growth tax for a lot of years in the state with an elf-based production tax, and we had it through the from and we have to remember that from 87 to 2004, and maybe it was 2005, the way that the oil prices were, the average oil price was something like $18 in the state for all those years. And the tax level for the companies was 67%. And the state, we had one of the highest tax rates literally in the world. And when people talk about now, say, well, some places have 70 or 80% tax rate, the trade-off for that kind of tax rate was that those countries paid back 150% of the capital investment within the first 5 years. That was the trade-off. They paid 150% back. They took the risk with the companies and then demanded a very high return. In Alaska, we took no risk with the companies and demanded a very high return. At the same time, the production was falling. We know from 88, when we had 2.1 million barrels a day, to now where we have 700,000. So when people were talking about tax and talking about a gas pipeline, but particularly tax, because that's the part I know about, Pedro Van Mieris in particular was saying, if you want a higher tax rate with higher prices, and you have maturing fields with higher capital costs, you are going to have to do something different. You're going to have to do something like they do in these other countries, where you take some of the risk in return for a higher take. And that's what PPT was all about, in return for the state getting more at higher costs, higher prices. At the same time the costs were rising, the state agreed to take some of the risk. And the legislators at that time, there was a lot of controversy, there remains a lot of controversy about this. It is a different system than there is anywhere, particularly in the United States. And it's a mix of systems between the United States and other states. And again, it's the state taking part of the risk in return for higher taxes when prices are higher. And everybody liked the idea about the higher taxes, and everybody was concerned about taking some of the risk. There was the same kinds of discussions that I hear today and I've heard through these committee through this year, took place last year. Legislators said, we want the state's interest protected. We do not want to be paying for gross negligence, for willful misconduct, from fraud. We don't want to have to pay for any costs incurred for containment, control, cleanup, or removal in connection with any unpermitted release of oil. Zero tolerance for spills. We will not pay any of that. And then, then we had the leak on August 6th. And on August 9th, the Senate Special Committee met, and they were looking even more carefully then at this whole idea of not wanting to be responsible for costs or losses related to spills. And Representative Olson is absolutely correct that the idea of improper maintenance was raised as amendment twice, once as Amendment 9 and once was as Amendment 13. And all the same difficulties that have been talked about by DNR, DEC, AOGCC, this time were talked about then. What does improper maintenance mean? It's not a legal term of art. How are you going to decide? All the issues. It didn't get to the floor because it was voted down in committee. When it came up again this year as a separate bill, as an amendment to PPT, it had a lot of sponsors because people were concerned and they wanted to take another look at it. It also had from every single agency, including DEC, DNR, AOGCC, DOR, problems with how the amendments were worded. That improper maintenance, you couldn't do anything with improper maintenance. That there are no standards for corrosion. It wasn't going to work the way it was presented. So there's been some changes talked about. There's changes still being talked about. From our viewpoint, the state is already protected. Immediately what happened in November last year, that I don't think any of the committees have discussed yet, and I hope that you will hold it in this committee till you've had a chance to get someone from Department of Law is that the response account from the 470 fund, the spill fund, the state took $8 million from that fund for a study by Department of Law and DEC for the recovery of all state costs and lost revenues from the spill. And that study is still ongoing. And they asked for $8 million because the largest component of these estimated costs is associated with document production.
You did a good job this morning.
Asking to involve over 208 million pages of documents. And DOL, Department of Law, is investigating and reviewing assessment of recovery of all costs and damages incurred by the state due to spill-related production shutdowns. So, under PPT already, the state had taken action to separately take a look at all the things you've talked about today that you're concerned about, ongoing. It did not require an amendment to the PPT. They were doing it under the authorizations that they already have. And when you look at the 18 exceptions for the state participating in risk, all of the things that you've talked about today are already taken care of. Lease expenditures would not include costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence. Costs incurred for containment, control, cleanup, or removal would not be included. Legislators last year were as concerned as you are this year, and many of you are the same legislators. The state did not want to, and you did not want the state to be held hostage to taking risks, to participate in risks that were badly handled on behalf of the company. Dr. Van Muers at the same time said, if you cannot, you are going to have, because of the Prudhoe Bay incident brought to the forefront, the concern about increasing capital costs, and how do you make a decision, how does an auditor make a decision every time a capital cost is shown as a potential deduction, how does that auditor make the decision about whether or not to red flag it? And Dr. Van Muers said, you are going to know the main one. On the others, instead of trying to do that, put a proxy in the 30-cent proxy. It's going to increase the taxes to the oil industry about $45 million a year. Whether or not there's an incident, whether or not there's been any maintenance issues, they're going to pay that much, because that's the reasonable maintenance requirements for a field this size. So on two or three fronts, the state was protected. Its interests were protected. What's happening now is, again, an attempt to add pieces to the PPT that are not required because the state's interests are already protected, and is going to add ambiguity to the bill and make it very difficult for the petroleum production tax system to work, which I guess some people see as a good outcome. That would be too bad, because it's going to throw us into the same situation we were in the growth tax and the ELF system, where because the legislature in the early days and the Department of Revenue did not spell out clearly what had to be done, we ended up with billions of dollars in tax disputes on the table. What happens when you start getting into the billions of dollars in tax disputes is that nobody can move. The companies can't move and the state agencies can't move because everybody's afraid that it will influence the outcome. You heard John Iverson talk about 3 years to audit from beginning to when people know what the decision has been. If you have an auditor starting to red flag things in the first year, and you don't know till the third year, and then 3 more years after that, and you're running 11.5% interest, and the auditor is going to be required to audit every, well, I don't know how they're going to decide what would be a red flag for an auditor, because under this bill, it's not tied to an incident. It's just tied to a capital expense that has been identified by the company for a deduction. A couple of other things, just in terms of some of the new language you have made a person in the Department of Natural Resources who's a lead person for exercising oversight, you have made that person equal with the Commissioner of Natural Resources, the Commissioner of DEC, and the Commissioner of DOR. You've given him equal weight, and this is a person who is not confirmed by the legislature. The second thing you've done is related to the repair and replacement of property that was not maintained or improperly maintained, and the incremental operating expenses from that, and diminished capacity. Two things that are going to be difficult to tie to and take a long time to tie to improper maintenance. You don't want operators worrying about shutting in capacity when they're trying to repair something. You don't want them to even be thinking about, gosh, this is going to mean, you know, problems with the audit. You want them to do what they have to do to be safe. So anything that you add that would even raise a thought about what would be the best thing to do other than safety is a wrong public policy, especially if you're able to get to credits that would work against the state's interest in language that's already there. We also think there is a problem with retroactivity as it's expressed in this bill, and we'll provide our testimony to you so that you can see that. I know that Rob Mintz had made comments earlier on to the same effect. We think that this is going to offset the whole purpose of this PPT legislation, which was to marry risk and higher taxes. You're covered by the 30 cents for those issues that are just simple negligence, as Commissioner Norman has pointed out at least a dozen times. So I'm very concerned about what this means in terms of constant legal struggle over things that no one else does. No other state does this, and the operators don't require this degree of simple negligence issues among themselves either.
Judy, it's Jay Ramirez. If I can interrupt you, I'll just, for the record, remind you what I shared with the producers in the House Oil and Gas Committee, which is if they simply didn't take the deductions in this case because of what I consider to whatever degree a matter of negligence, and I think that's being borne out at the congressional level as well as here in the state of Alaska, we would not have had to contemplate this kind of onerous legislation. So it's a little bit like the example I used in oil and gas was the example of anybody in this room who has been in a car accident and has had to make the decision, are you going to self-insure for the accident and pay, or are you going to contact State Farm or Allstate or whoever your carrier is and run the risk that your premiums are going to increase, that you're going to be dropped as an insured, and this is the case with the producers. Had they said straightforwardly that they were going to assume responsibility for this and pay the full cost and not use the deductible formula that was allowable for them under PPT, I don't think that we would have seen House Bill 128 before us. So with all due respect, I lay the blame squarely at the feet of the producers for not handling this situation properly. And as a result, they're going to get an onerous piece of legislation. And your comments are greatly appreciated. I will open it up for questions to the member. But the issue before us is not to deliberate so much on the merits of the bill. That has been done under the jurisdiction of Oil and Gas and Resources. The burden before this committee is to test the legal tools and what we're putting in the arsenal for Department of Law, Department of Revenue, and Department of Natural Resources, so that if they are taken into court by the producers, that they can defend the state's interest. Are there any questions for Judy Brady from AOGA? Judy, I don't see any questions here from the committee. Do you have any final remarks that you'd like to make?
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. The one final remark I would make is that it would be good for the committee to have someone from the Department of Law who is involved in this $8 million study to see what exactly what cost the state believes it has coming to it now, Department of Law and DEC, because that's exactly what they are doing. And so that being the case, the additions to the bill are unnecessary, and because the state's interests are already being taken a look at by the state, by Department of Law and DEC, who have jurisdiction here. So the question of who did what to whom and when is still very much open in terms of this bill, and I'm sure it will be a matter of court case, which the state has a perfect right to pursue and is pursuing using 470 money. Thank you very much.
Judy, thank you very much, and thank you for your service to the state of Alaska. I maintain that of all the people that visit Juneau, you are amongst the most regal, and you elevate the quality of any committee that you testify in over the phone or particularly in person, and I will miss you. Anyway, thank you. Seeing no other questions, are there other questions for Mr. Banks or for Ethan or for Mr. Bullock for the bill sponsor, Representative Broomberg?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we were kind of exploring the statute of limitations issue, and I didn't know if Ethan or anybody else wanted to take that on, or do you want to just get back to us on that?
Through the chair, Representative Grimberg, do you mean the application of this particular bill? Well, I think we spoke about that a little earlier this afternoon, and the previous speaker mentioned that Rob Mintz had some concerns about it. I don't recall those. He may have expressed some concerns about retroactivity before various committees, but
I'm now on to statutes of limitations.
Oh, okay. Statutes of limitations. That's something that I haven't looked at.
Should we inquire Mr. Mintz on that issue?
Whoever. Mr. Bullock, will you?
And then we'll go to Representative.
He was moving back into the zone.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, this is a tax bill. And it just has to do about qualifications to take a deduction and to qualify for a credit. The other issues that relate to other losses the state may have are separate litigation. And if those other losses would include a loss of tax revenue, then it would be the net amount after the application of the deductions that are provided for in current law, and that would be provided by this tax bill. But this is a tax bill, and it's subject to the three-year statute. Unless there's fraud, then there's no statute.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Bullock. It's very helpful to reframe this as a tax bill that really clarifies for me, what is the nature of House Bill 128? It's a fine redefinition. Representative Samuel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question regarding you and I had this discussion what seems like a lifetime ago, last time I thought about this bill. If BP chose not to take the deductions, just as a matter of course, does that become an admission in their criminal case and therefore they have to take the deductions, and by not taking the deductions, do they put themselves at risk in a potential federal criminal case with an admission?
Interesting. The chair, one thing that's related to this is the confidentiality of the tax return. The Department of Revenue would be precluded from disclosing the deduction or whether it was or was not taken on the return.
Until the FBI came in and seized the records?
Well, those are tough ones to seize.
Susan, that's Don Bullock. Just
and the other question, I guess, probably for Mr. Banks, and I don't know what changed, and I apologize if this already was over while I was gone, but there seemed to be the issue on the definition of improper. And has that been fleshed out in the last 2 months as this has gone through the process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Samuels, there has been in Section 2 the addition of the definition now of good oil field practices, and so that now includes a reference to industry standards as published by organizations like the American Petroleum Institute and the American Society for Testing and Materials. It also refers to federal regulations and so forth. So it does try to get its arms around the issue of improper maintenance by reference to those standards.
Okay, and one further question. Did anybody discuss the ongoing criminal case? Is it a federal case? Is it a state case? Is it both against the individuals or the company as a whole?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, litigation is being handled by a different section, and I have not had any contact.
But there is ongoing state criminal litigation?
Yeah. Well, there's ongoing litigation with the DEC. Now, I don't know if there's actual criminal.
Susan, that's Ethan back now. Just
because
we have so many people up here.
I don't know if there's actually criminal charges in that case or not. It's certainly something I can find out for you.
And at the federal level? And look at the sponsor, too, if you know. Is there a federal criminal investigation going on BP or individuals?
Not that I'm aware of either.
Okay, thank you.
Mary Jackson.
She had a question.
Mary Jackson? Do you have something to add? Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Senator Tom Wagner. Through the chair, Representative Samuels, the congressional offices are having hearings. There were hearings that were established for, and I want to say it was the 2nd of May or the 3rd of May. I don't have those dates right. They have been postponed because the information that was supposed to have come from the company at question was not available. The company at question said they were going to provide more. So to that extent, yes, there is that federal investigation.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just throw something in, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. Through the chair, Representative Samuels, there is in your packet a couple of memos from John Dingell, Chairman of the Committee on Energy and Energy and Commerce, that do reference the hearings. I believe towards the back of that. Mr. Chairman, just more of a statement. I'm more curious rather than just a congressional hearing. Is there a criminal charge filed against these people that would stop? Would it affect BP coming forward and claiming? Because that would then be used as evidence against them. And is that in the realm of possibility? I'm not a lawyer, and there's not a gotcha question here. I'm just...
Representative Samuels, through the chair, I don't have an answer for you, sir.
Okay. But I remember when we first had the hearings, when it first happened, then-Attorney General Marquez was pushed forward, and the feds were looking at criminal charges being filed against individuals and the company. And does that play into your question is constantly just don't do it? And I'm wondering if there's more to that question than meets the eye when you have a federal case involved. I don't have a clue.
The congressional hearings that Jane just showed me with him on May 17th, May 16th, another week. Sort of interesting time. Representative Greenberg.
Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who I would ask, which of you attorneys I would ask this to. If you look on page 4, line 19, you have, and the transportation of oil, gas, produced water, and other fluids. Why is it limited to other fluids and doesn't include other gases?
Well, gas is broadly defined. There's many kinds of gas.
Or anybody, I'll ask any.
Yes, is.
Mr. Chair, my name is Donald Bullock. Part of this relates to good oil field practice and the implication that it includes good gas field practice, too. Generally, the gas is associated with oil, although there are some gas-only leases. You could add, if you wanted to more directly address the gas issue. It's not addressed as significantly as oil is in this bill. That's an amendment you may wish to consider.
I'm not in this area through the chair. I don't know if that would be helpful or not. I just, it was a question. I don't know. Or is there anybody here who does know?
Through the chair, the section you referred to is just generally trying to establish some sort of standards that the director of, well, actually the Commissioner of Revenue through his directors and auditors would just use for a basis. So it's not that they'd look only to liquids, but just general practices that they would expect to have followed by producers in the state.
I believe, Representative Gruenberg, it is a broad definition, even though it's a brief definition. Sometimes brevity is
big. Mr. Chair, on line 17, they state maintenance of oil and gas facilities. Specifically mentioned gas.
Yes. Yes, sir. Thank you, Representative. So my question, gentlemen, is for me, you've already satisfied the test that we have, in fact, have before us a tax bill that is much narrower in scope than the larger overhaul that we produced last year, and that we have defensible language that the Department of Law on behalf of DNR or Department of Revenue can go into a court of law. Is there anything else that
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to respond to Representative Gruenberg's question. I'm not sure how lawyers would think about the question of gas and then the produced water and other fluids, whether other fluids modified produced water only. Most engineers think about the movement of substances through pipelines and these processings. They're all kinds of fluids. Gaseous gas is just a different state for that.
So that through the chair, that would include transportation of gases other than hydrocarbon gases.
Mr. Chairman, I would think that that's possible. Right. I mean, I'll take it on advisement and get back to you, but like I say, engineers are typically thinking about different phases and pipelines.
It's not necessary unless you think something we have to do about it.
So, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you. I'm glad that we've satisfied that for you. So if we can come back, is there anything? Don Bullock, yes, sir.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I may have misspoken. This just has to do with the standards that would be expected in an oil field, whatever they're transporting to the pipeline. So there could be other things other than the production itself from the wells that are moving about the field. And this just leaves that open so that everything's covered.
So my question is, as we round the 3 o'clock hour, there are no amendments that are to be offered by members of this committee so far as I know. Do any of you recommend any amendments that would enhance this piece of legislation or amendments that would narrow the language in this legislation to make it stronger so that if the state must articulate its case or its point of view or defend itself in a court of law, do you feel that this is satisfactory in its present form? I think that you have shown the committee, you've demonstrated the committee that it's that improper maintenance is defensible, that retroactivity is defensible. Is there anything that you would like us to tweak, add, or delete before we make a query of the committee to see whether there's a will to move this piece of legislation? Do you want to phone a friend?
No, I was just wondering. I know, having the experience, Mr. Chairman, of being online.
The experience of being online often is that you're pushing on your mute button trying to get the chance to speak.
Mr. Mintz, would you like to go to Mr. Mintz?
Mr. Iverson.
Oh, Mr. Iverson. Mr. Iverson, are you with us?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I didn't have anything to add. Thank you for the opportunity, though.
Okay. So we are going to be able to leave this, that the state is satisfied, that our drafter is satisfied, Mr. Bullock, and we thank you very much for your service, and oil and gas is satisfied, and the Department of Revenue is satisfied. Is that where we are leaving this presently?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the bill provides a standard that can be applied.
Very good. And seeing no other objections, Vice Chair Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the CS for House Bill number 128, version L, with attached physical notes and individual recommendations.
All right. Seeing no objections, House Bill 128 moves from committee. It's 5 minutes after three. We thank Sponsor Conrad. Exceptional job, dear. Very thorough.
Nice.
Presentation is appreciated.
Nice.
Yes.
And, before we adjourn, Representative Gruenberg has worked on a draft letter. And
are we going to meet again this year?
Oh yeah, we're meeting again today.
Okay.
Tomorrow.
I don't want to deal with it today.
What's the subject matter?
I guess it's the region thing.
Okay. I don't want to deal with that. Then with that, we're adjourned.